All right. Good morning, good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of the Simon Law Group Justice Team podcast. We got a very special episode today, full of former defense professionals now working on the other side of the wall in East Berlin. Or is it West Berlin? We don't know.
We've got that empty chair over there. No pun intended. It should be Jenny. I think she's at mediation.
Yeah, we're missing Jenny. She's got a lot of the good knowledge, but we got plenty of talent here. Before we get going, though, Bar Boy Marat, what do we have on drinks today?
All right. Well, for this special group of folks, I decided to make one of Orange County's finest cocktails, the Paloma. Today it's made with Casamigos Blanco. So George Clooney or Randy Gerber, if you guys want to sponsor the show, follow, look for us on Instagram and give us a holler.
No, we're never going corporate. We're keeping it DIY, right, Timmy? All right, rock on. I'm Tom Conroy of the Simon Law Group. I am the sugar-free version of the Toms here. More aspartame, less sugar. But I'm your host for today. Joined here by Ryan. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello.
It's Ryan Conger, also works here with us at the firm. And we got Nick. Say hello, Nick.
Hello.
Nick, where are you out of?
Dixon, Cohan, and Babel. I'm in Newport Beach.
Super. Outstanding. And we got Dave Reinhardt on the couch. Dave, say
hello. Hello there.
Dave, how are you?
I'm great today.
Last time I saw Dave was at a golf tournament in Orange County on a Monday, and that's very far from where I live, and we had a great time. We had a lot of fun, but I didn't tell my wife specifically I was going golfing that day.
I remember this now.
I just said I had something in Orange County, and I didn't get home till like 9:30, and that just happened to be the day that she got locked out of the house and was just sitting there in the dark on the porch waiting for me to come home.
Lost my key.
Next on the couch, my wife.
Yeah. But you know, I remember you hit a couple of great drives that day, so it's all worth it.
Yeah. Z, say hi.
Hello.
Tell us who you are and why you're here.
My name is Zanetta Conroy. I am with the Swanson Law Group, recently on plaintiff side since about 3 weeks ago.
All right. Oh, wow. Fresh off the boat.
Fresh off the boat.
All right. Here we are.
Welcome.
Yeah. So thank today you. We're going to talk about loosely the idea of who's on the other side of the fence in terms of defense setup, insurance adjuster setup, and why we think it's a good idea to know who's over there. And we have some pretty good defense experience in the room, I think. Everybody's got at least, 7, 8, 9 years on the other side of the wall, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Nick, you got what?
10.
10 in the barrel. Dave, about 12?
15.
15, yeah. Ryan, you were a partner at one point, right, somewhere?
Yeah, I was 7 or 8 on the defense and 5 or so on the plaintiff.
Okay. And Zanetta, you had, 7 years?
7 years, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Is there a common theme there?
Yeah, I spent a good summer as a clerk on the defense side. I'm clerking here now, and I'm hoping to get a real job.
What is that? The 7 or 8 year mark?
What's 7 year itch?
Is there something magic about the 7 or 8 year mark?
Because yeah.
We all just said 7, 8.
Well, that may be a topic for another podcast, but there is, I think, and we can, I don't know, maybe explore it, but there's a 7 year itch people tend to get, 7, 8, not 10, but.
I wonder what you figure out after 7 or 8 years. On the
I think you realize at that point it's a ride or die thing. Either.
What do you think, Ryan? What did you figure out at 7 or 8 years?
I don't know. What did I figure out? You seem like you have something in mind.
I don't. Yeah. I don't.
I think that's the commitment point. Either you say you're in it or you're out.
Right.
I think that's right.
Yep. All right. So let's do this. Let's for people who may be unfamiliar with or want to learn more about who's on the other side of the wall in their litigations. Let's start here and identify some of our players on the other side. Let's talk about who we're up against, because when we talk about an insurance company or a defense firm or adjusters, we're talking about people. We're talking about people with jobs, people with personalities. So let's first maybe go through and identify who we might encounter on the other side. It's, let's say, of a defense firm. Who are we likely to see? And we'll talk about a file. Let's say it's a not a great file, not a bad file, just sort of your average, decent-sized case. Who's over there?
And maybe we could start from soup to nuts, right? Chronological order. So the first thing is you have, that low-level adjuster.
Right.
Who gets the file, gets the notice of claim, he or she. Then you have, in that hierarchy, you have their boss, their boss's boss, rolls all the way up. But then the file's transferred to, a litigation adjuster. And you maybe have staff counsel. Something at insurancecompany.com is their email address. After that, panel counsel? after panel counsel, maybe conflict counsel, some coverage counsel. Who am I missing? And then within the insurance company?
If you're lucky, excess counsel.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So let's talk about the insurance folks, the adjusters at various stages. In your experience, who do we have on the adjustment tower? Nick's mentioned that you might have maybe a claim adjuster that might transfer to a litigation adjuster. But who else do we see commonly that is, you know, it's not just one person, right?
Right. There's the main adjuster who is handling the file, and the level of adjuster, it just depends on the value that they put on the case. So it could be a lower level adjuster, it could be mid-level, could be someone higher up, but there's always a supervisor. There's always a supervisor's supervisor. So there's a lot of people involved with looking at a file on the claim side.
When you're a defense lawyer, if you're the partner or the associate on it, do you like to have just one person you're dealing with, one adjuster? Or do you want to, or is it more bothersome when you got more people looking at the file? What do you think, Dave?
It just depends on the case. It goes up the chain of command. You usually deal with the person who's the adjuster. That's who you day-to-day talk to, send the reports to. And then when you start getting money on the case, usually is when you might have to deal with managers or claims review committees, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I always found that the higher up you go, the easier it is to get money. Those folks made it they didn't make it all the way to those high levels by getting whacked for millions.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Dave brought up an interesting idea here. There's the idea of a committee, or the idea of different people getting together. In my experience, one of the more interesting parts of being a defense lawyer was the defense roundtable.
Right.
We have experience with this.
Yeah.
Those are the worst.
Yeah. I learned how to argue in court from being on roundtables. They're firing questions at you just like a judge would.
And who's on the roundtable, Nick? Who would be on?
So a roundtable would be, you know, your individual adjuster that you're working with on the case that you've dealt with from the beginning. Your boss who knows nothing about the case, usually. And then you have probably like a regional director. And depending on the value of the case or whether there's coverage issues, you may have higher up. One thing that I always loved about roundtables is sometimes I would hear voices and I didn't know who they were. And they'd be firing questions at me. And later I would find out, the head of national claims was the one giving you a hard time about your liability theory. And you don't realize that you just went toe-to-toe with a guy who's been, you know, the head of claims for the insurance company.
Okay. So did you find the exercise of the roundtables productive, informative?
I mean, look, from the insurance perspective, from a defense perspective, I think it's a necessary evil. They vet. It's like plaintiff lawyers when we all sit around and talk about our cases and you trade stories, but you're talking about the case. All the issues are vetted. I will say the problem is it's a big momentum thing. So if there's a negative vibe on that case, you're not getting any money, even if you need it.
You know, I was going to say, Nick, that you talking about answering all those questions and stuff. One thing I think people lose sight of is a lot of times a defense lawyer is your advocate trying to get money on a case. And so you really want to treat those people well because they're actually taking your position and trying to convince regional managers or national managers, like, we need to get money on this case.
Right. Well, 100%. I mean, you know, if I have a good relationship with a plaintiff's attorney, or I had, and, you know, I will go to bat for you. If I like your case, I like your client, you know, I will stick my neck out and argue your position. So, I mean, I think that's something important to keep in mind.
So a moment ago when I broached the idea of roundtables, we heard from Nick who's had experience with it that he found productive or valuable, and you, Z, you were saying, oh, the worst. So what's sticking out, what's in your mind that when you look back on roundtables, you say, uh-oh, this is a bit of a challenge for me?
Well, it's just that a lot of times defense counsel and adjusters don't see eye to eye on value. Sometimes you do, but a lot of times you don't. And so a lot of times they question, why do you think this case is worth so much? We have these amazing defenses, but, you know, they're looking at it from a very narrow viewpoint. Like, they don't see the whole picture. And so it's sometimes hard to make your point because they're stuck in this viewpoint and they can't see past it.
I represented a doctor one time. He had a great line for adjusters and that kind of thing, and he said, they've got the reckless courage of the non-combatant.
Exactly.
So, that is scathing.
That is great. You know,
one thing I would add is, I mean, so I think the context of a roundtable, too, is remember, at least for me, it was like call in at 11:22. They've been doing roundtables all morning, right. And you pop on, and while you're on, you hear the beeps coming on. They're just dealing case after case after case after case from the various different firms that are handling their cases. So I think your point was a great one, is I think they lost a lot of context of like the forest through the trees. They may look at one fact or have one question and want you to go run and get it, and they don't understand the big picture. I found that to be the most difficult. Like, yeah, you're right, that defense may work, but practically, I don't think they always realized what was going to happen in a courtroom with those defenses.
So is it a fair thing that we can say, you know, as we're on the plaintiff side, is our principal points of contact are going to be the handling attorney and maybe an adjuster, but what we have in their background, in their headset, is a lot of voice, a lot of information coming through that maybe it's not being filtered, or they can't get through to the voice can't get through to them. They just got a lot of information coming to them.
Yeah, and I think the point you made earlier about being nicer, I talk about with colleagues and people in my firm and outside of the firm, and Ryan and I talk about at times, is when to turn from nice to not nice, kind of like a temperature thing. Mm-hmm. Instead of it being black and white, you start off maybe gears, right? You're in first gear. When to go to second or to third? You don't just go from first to fifth. You gotta, and depending, when to be loved, when to be feared in these cases.
You know, Ryan told me just before we started, he's like, I've had a good year being nice to people. I've been reasonable all year. It's worked out for me.
This business ebbs and flows for sure. And sometimes you feel like, man, like, is anybody ever going to pay me on anything? And then other times it feels like, you know, everything's just rolling along nice. Things have been good lately, so I'm probably due for a down. But I think you made a good point, which is, you know, especially on a bigger case, you've got this group of people that's making the decision, and it may not be, as the plaintiff's attorney, anyone that you're actually even able to communicate with. You may not even know that person's name, right? So having done the defense, I think, is where we have the advantage of, because what you really want to do is you want to be communicating with those decision makers somehow, even though you don't have daily access to them. So what can we do as plaintiff's lawyers to have our voices heard in that room? We want our message being put across in that round table. I think one of the things you can do is get along with the defense lawyer so that your case moves to the front of the stack, so that you've talked to them, you've communicated with them, they know how you see the case, and that's, they're almost just regurgitating what you told them in the room. You're making their job easy, right? If you write a really nice demand letter, guess what that becomes? Their initial report. Mm-hmm. Right? But if you write a crap demand letter, then they have to write the initial report themselves, and they might dig a little deeper, might find some more warts in your case. I don't know. I think it's all about making it easy for the defense
attorney.
That's
one thing I think you add is it's being nice, but I don't know if nice is the right word. It's being professional, mm-hmm. in that you give them the information, but they also know that you're not blowing smoke,
right.
That you're confident in your case. And it's like, you know, what good trial lawyers say, you got to believe in what you're selling out there. And it's from the very moment they interact with you, from the first phone call, you're always on with these adjusters or the defense attorney, because like you said, you want them to be your advocate.
Ryan and I we talk about this stuff a lot. We have this like view that the scariest guy is not the one who's breathing fire and smoke and writing the 9-paragraph emails about how he's going to wreck you. It's the kind of nonchalant confidence of, hey man, here's my case. I got 10 positives, 2 negatives. Here's all the material you need to know. And we're going to ask for $10 million. And you shake his hand and go, oh, I'm a deep shit.
Right, right.
Exactly.
Competence goes a long way. Yeah. I mean, that's really true.
And those guys also tend to be like this, right? So you could go through the whole depo. They never object. It's all smiles. You're all friends. You get to that one issue that they're trying to guard, and they're just all over you for 30 seconds, and then back to being nice again.
Yeah.
Right? Right?
Yeah.
Like, not going to happen, not right now, and then now we're cool again.
We won't do names, but I'm going to go against the marital privilege here. Z's fate, when you're on the defense side, the number one favorite plaintiff lawyer you saw was the guy who was just knightly almost in his professionalism, right?
He was, yeah. He was an amazing attorney. He wasn't overly nice where, you know, we were like friends, but I respected him and I totally went to bat on
his
case.
Even remember having cases with you.
Oh, yes. For the win. Windmill dunk. All right, so let's talk a little bit about maybe conflicts. We're talking about...
Can I talk about something real quick
on
that
vein? Of course.
This is something that I struggle with. A lot of times you're handling a case and they're sending this not very seasoned, I'll say, associate, and they clearly don't understand the case. And all I'm thinking in my head is, I've got this huge case, and this person is reporting nonsense up the line. And I get terrified that, you know, it's going to be too late by the time anybody who actually... can influence this case can will know what's actually happening.
Okay.
I mean, it's
I think that's when you got to start making demands above the policy, sending
I want to speak to your manager.
You know, right. And getting forcing that somebody some other eyes onto the case, right? Because yeah. All of a sudden now they're like they have to report that to the insured and say, "Hey, you know, they're asking for $10 million and you only have $1 million policy. What do you want to do?" And now maybe there's some adults have to come into the room.
Right. Yeah, that's Ryan, that's a perfect point. I always, in that situation, what happens more often than we'd like, I always find a way to get myself on the phone or in front of the person that I think is that next level.
Right.
A demand, or you're at the depot at the defense attorney's office. You walk into the partner's office and introduce yourself. "Hey, I'm Nick Cohan. I'm the plaintiff's attorney. You got a minute to talk about the case?"
Without breaking code, too, because you don't want to be like, you know, "Hey, your associate's an idiot, right. And here's what's
that's
going on."
That's my temptation always.
Ryan, they pay you the big bucks to operate with nuance, okay? That's why. It's actually a nice jumping off point. I'm glad Dave kind of segued here. But we get into this idea that, you know, we on the plaintiff side, maybe we got our teams, we got our setup, we're all in lockstep, we know where we're going with our case and our litigation team. Is it our experience that on the defense side we encounter dissension in the ranks? Do we have all these different people, certain adjusters at certain levels, certain lawyers at certain levels? Is everybody in lockstep all the time, or is there tension and dissension in the ranks? What have we seen?
That was my least favorite thing about being a defense lawyer, was like I trying to figure out what exactly is my motive here. Am I working for this firm? Am I working for this insurance company? Am I working for this insured client?
Well, let me ask you the pointed question that I get sometimes from non-lawyers. When you're an insurance defense lawyer, who's your client?
The insured.
Right?
Well, all day.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's
to whom are you reporting, and who is paying the settlement, who's paying your bill?
The insurer.
That's why it's the tripartite relationship.
Right.
No, who is paying, the insurer is paying the firm's bill, but you know who's paying my bill is the firm.
Right, okay.
Right? So that's why it gets pretty tricky. On the plaintiff side, it's pretty simple. You know, you and your client both have the same objective. That's to get as much money as possible. It's pretty basic. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot better.
So we have the famous tripartite relationship on the insurance side, where you've got three people in the room. You've got an insurer, a lawyer, and the insured. And as a defense lawyer, you've got... Not only do you have different bosses and different supervisors in your ear, but you actually have, ethically or professionally, maybe two different clients, one and a half clients.
It is ethically. Yeah. I mean, you're duty-bound by both.
Yeah.
And that's why there's Kuma's counsel and personal counsel and all those issues that we could have a whole other podcast on about.
Well, let's spend a minute here. We've identified some people in the insurance structure. We've identified some people in the legal structure. Who are some of the peripheral characters we may bump into along the way?
We have personal counsel, Kuma's counsel, excess counsel.
Explain Kuma's counsel, Nick.
So,
yeah, you explain it because Ryan would like you to explain it.
What do you think it is, Ryan? I mean, my understanding of Kuma's counsel is there's a conflict based on coverage. That then, and there's a case, Kumis, right. That's where it comes from.
C-U-M-I-S.
C-U-M-I-S, yeah. And that because of that conflict on coverage, there is now the insured needs their own attorney paid by the insurance company to represent just that insured's interests. Because some covering provisions, usually happens when there's a reservation of rights, some covering provisions could create an exclusion where there is no coverage.
Right.
So... Go ahead.
I was going to say, and personal counsel is different in what respect?
Personal counsel, there may not be a reservation of rights yet. Mm-hmm. There may not be a coverage issue. Inherent in the tripartite relationship is a conflict, but they don't say that, right?
Right.
Inherent is the insurance company wants to pay as little as possible, and you just want to get out. The insurer just wants to get out of the case. Mm-hmm. That's an inherent conflict. So personal counsel is banging on the door of the insurance company, pay, where the insurance company is saying, look, we're trying to resolve this within our reserves and all the things that they do.
I once had a client whose personal counsel was a guy that got him out of a traffic ticket one time, and he wouldn't let me do one single thing without that guy's approval.
Was that, Ryan, did that create conflict? Right. In my experience, if when personal counsel gets involved, often enough it's a situation where the insurance company has been asked to pay a settlement through a demand and they have declined. But now there's a potential bad faith, open policy type thing. And insurance or the personal counsel gets involved and they just beat you down
right
until something happens. So that there is just an enormous amount of conflict you might find.
And as plaintiff's counsel, personal counsel should be your best friend. When you see personal counsel, right, you want to make friends with that person.
Go to letters for them.
Yes. Right.
They're on your side. They want to shake money out of the insurance tree, and that's why they
and sometimes personal counsel. I mean, I'm joking about the guy. Well, I'm not, but you know, sometimes personal counsel is not a tort attorney. Sometimes personal counsel is just a trusted friend or family friend who doesn't understand the game that we play. So it's really good to get with that person and explain, okay, here's exactly what you should do to protect your client.
Yeah, sometimes they really gum everything up.
Yeah,
it's just brutal.
The wild card. I'm going to throw a little wild card in here.
I had a personal counsel be a well-known plaintiff's attorney, and he did not know, we'll say he or she, we'll leave the name out. He or she did not know what his job was.
Right.
And it took me calling other people that we all knew, like, look, you need to call the guy and tell him, like, get me paid and this case will be over. Right. I couldn't believe I ended up at the end being friends with the defense attorney to get the case settled around personal counsel, which is totally backwards.
So we're talking about some outside influences, Zanetta, within the structure of the regular old insurance channels themselves, the regular old adjusting channels. Do we find conflict? I mean, we got a couple adjusters all working for the same unit. We got a defense lawyer working for the adjusters. Seems pretty seamless.
There's a lot of conflict. There's rarely a case where you agree with or defense counsel agrees with the adjuster. When I was on defense, it was either my valuation was too low, why is it so low, shouldn't we have a bigger reserve, or why are you so high, we have X, Y, and Z defense. So there's conflict there, which sometimes, you know, during roundtables, you kind of talk about it. But it's, you know, you don't always see eye to eye with the adjuster on a value.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
Marat, I'm parched.
One thing.
Coming right up.
One thing I was to add is
I'll be parched in about 2 minutes. So.
When I describe the situation.
Greatest compliment.
When I describe the situation to people, remember, the insurance company is a huge corporation. And we've all seen The Office and all the SNL parodies about these huge corporations. They're insidious. I mean, these people are competing on all these type of levels and performance matrix. So it's kind of cutthroat in these insurance companies. And then you come in as the defense attorney with an evaluation on a case. I mean, look, some insurance companies are evaluated their adjusters by efficiency, right? They get the file. How quickly do they resolve it? Then some evaluate it by their reserves. How much below the reserves did they settle it by? I mean, we can come up with a number of reasons that we've all heard adjusters being evaluated by. So, of course, there's going to be conflict because the people on the top are pushing the people on the bottom down, and the people on the bottom, the adjusters are fighting to be the best so they can get the promotion.
So, open question. So, if we understand this, that we got this situation where there's just inherent baked-in conflict for any number of reasons with us on this side, what can we do with that? How can we synthesize that? How can we use that as an advantage or as information? I mean, it's nice to know this. It's nice to understand this, but what can we use that for? How do we approach that?
Yeah, I'm not sure because a lot of that stuff is so behind the scenes that you're not going to know, you know, what some individual adjuster's motivation is.
I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier, and that is, you know, utilize the defense attorney as best you can. Provide them with the information that they need to go to bat for you, or in the instance where you have I think it's really good to just understand what everyone's motives are, right? And once you have that, you can sort of take it on a case-by-case basis. So if you have an excess carrier who is waiting in the wings while the primary layer or the SAR is, you know, being cavalier with their exposure, use that to your advantage. Get on the phone with the excess carrier and say, do you know what's going on? Are they really reporting this to you? Whose eyes are on this thing? Because if it hits for 10 million, nine of it's yours. Right. You know?
I think the best thing you said is motivations, right? Is understand. Each case is different. Each set of facts is different. Each layers of insurance. With public entity, right? You have a big SIR. Some companies have a big SIR. It's a products case. There's a million different things. Understanding all the different motivations allows you to get home, which is what you say in the beginning. Get the most money we can for our clients.
I think the point is you have to think about it.
Right.
You can't treat every case the same. And a lot of times, you know, you can do that. And if you take a step back and go, okay, what's this particular situation here? Where are the insurance levels? All that kind of stuff, then you can actually do something that's maybe effective to...
Right. But you're right, Dave. You really have to think about it. Every situation is completely different. And that's why it's nice to have that, you know, for any young listeners out there who are thinking about that first job, even if you want to ultimately be on the side of light, maybe working for the defense for a few years isn't the worst thing in the world because we kind of breathe it.
I caught that too.
Yeah.
The side of light.
You know, I want to talk about something you talked about just real quick, and that is, you know, getting the defense lawyer the information they need. And we kind of all know that. I think there's still some people who are stuck in the mindset they're the enemy and, you know, I'm not going to give them anything. The other issue for them is where you can help them is with time. You know, if you make a demand and it's got a 5-day, you know, limit on it, you know, that lawyer has to get through the 100,000 level, the 250 level, the 500 level, the million level, and it just can't happen in that time. And I think a lot of people feel like, hey, there's this strength of like, I'm not going to give you an extension on my 998 and I'm going to be really tough. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you may want to give them an extension so that they can actually do their job if you perceive that it's somebody who's trying to help you.
I completely agree. And that's just something you have to kind of work your way through and figure out on your own too, because for every 5 extensions that are requested, 4 are with selfish motivations, but one of them is probably with a pure motivation. You might actually get paid if you give the extension.
Well, and the other thing is you're giving that extension, you're kind of giving them enough rope to hang themselves, which is ultimately what you want, right? You want the policy to be open. So I'm always trying to err on the side of, you know, what do they want? Give them that. I mean, obviously within reason, but...
Right, but if someone asks you, hey, you just made a policy limits demand. We have a mediation in 3 months. Can we leave it open until the day after the mediation?
Right.
What's your response there? Why do you need the extra 3 months?
Right.
Our motivation is to get the most we can for our client. I think on the defense side, the primary... Everybody's got a little different motivation, but the main theme is don't die. Right?
The main theme is CYA.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Don't die. Exactly right.
Right. It's like we're trying to win the game. And many times I think they just want to make sure they can win the press conference.
Right. Well, here's an interesting point, the pivot point. Talking about motivations, we'll bump into along the way panel counsel, who's been retained by an insurance company to provide services. We'll bump into in-house counsel. Do they have different motivations, whether it's in-house or panel?
Definitely.
The firms themselves, the lawyers themselves.
In-house counsel, we had, in-house has a lot of files. You're trying to close as many files as you can. You have a certain quota you have to meet, certain monthly quota, certain yearly quota. And so as many files as you can settle, that's your goal.
Okay, so if we're out there and we're dealing with someone we know to be in-house counsel, we might want to keep in mind that this person isn't going to try, usually, speaking in generalities, is not going to want to go scorched earth or tick every box or take every depot. They want to get closures to score some points to get that bonus.
Right, you want to get as much information as you can, which goes back to the point we were talking about, you know, if defense counsel asks you, you know, if you're client had surgery or something, it's like, can I get a picture of the scar now? Can I get this? You know, if you say no, well, then you're not going to get anywhere. If you say yes, here you go, then it's like, look, adjuster, there's this picture, it's bad. You know, I know your computer's number, you know, is whatever, but you got to put more value because we have more information and it's worth more now. So
I found staff or in-house, right? The first line of on the lawyers that work for the insurance company, I found them to be that if you make their lives easier, they are going to pay you.
They each have 100 files.
Yeah, like 150 files.
Yeah.
And even with that, they'll have like a discovery department and medical record department and a depot department. And, they're
and guess what? One of them just closed down, by the way. Right. 100 files, and they just lost Law and Motion.
Exactly. or an attorney just quit.
Yeah.
What do you think about this, though? I do, and this may just be based on my limited experience because I was only panel counsel, but from the plaintiff's side, it feels sometimes like house counsel has less to lose. Like, they're not going to lose the client if, you know, they're not going to lose. Whereas panel counsel feels like if they screw up a case bad enough, they could lose a big account for the firm. Right.
I also think that plays into that is the personality type that is going to be, you know, in-house counsel versus someone who's like wants to be a partner in a major firm. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know,
that is a different person.
There's hardworking in-house counsel lawyers, but a lot of times they're like, hey, it's 5 o'clock. Like, I'm out.
Late. Yeah, exactly. Four, more like four.
What'd you get in early?
Yeah. Well, right.
And what about this? The small shop panel counsel who's trying to prove itself to get more files from that big insurance company may be willing to take more risk than the big established panel counsel firm who's already got those clients and is just trying not to lose them.
Sure. And then there's the big panel counsel who's like, we've had this client for 30 years. If I get hit on one case, that insurance company's not leaving.
Yeah.
I think it goes to what you said earlier. Every case is different.
Yeah, don't just sit down at your computer, start banging out work on a new file or when you're about to approach that moment. Sit down and think for a second. Who's on the other side here? What are they motivated by? What am I dealing with here? And I guess it's a little bit of a conversation we're having today. We mentioned a couple things a few moments ago. SIR, Ryan. What are we dealing with when we're dealing with SIR?
A self-insured retention.
Ooh, that sounds dangerous. Self-insured?
So the insured.
Where do we see that?
Well, we see that a lot of times with bigger corporations, a lot of times with trucking companies. I feel like we see the SIR, especially the big SIR. Sometimes you may have $1 million SIR, and that means that the insured, it's actually their money, the first million. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's burning, which means that every dollar that's spent is coming off of the top of that million.
Costs and attorney's fees. You mean.
Yeah, but yep. I do find on those cases, you're dealing with a different animal because you're not dealing with a company that does risk analysis as its business. You're dealing with a company that transports goods or drives trucks as its business, and they hired one or two guys to be in-house counsel and risk analysis. They're not as sophisticated a lot of times.
They spend that money like it's theirs too.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is different sometimes in right. an insurance company.
Yeah, my experience with the SIR is you're not dealing with an insurance adjuster who is a risk mitigation professional. You're often up against the first point of contact there on the quote unquote risk side is like a general counsel or some other financial professional who's in charge of overseeing this. And that person, broadly speaking, thinks differently than your typical adjuster or typical insurance setup. So it affects things pretty greatly because you're dealing with somebody else than what you're accustomed to.
Well, and they tend to take it more personally, too.
Suing them. Their money, their product.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about reporting. Z, you used to love reporting.
Loved reporting.
We hear about reports that the insurance companies do. I think we're all broadly familiar with them on this side. But for those who may not be familiar with what goes into a report or why, what's the deal with reporting on that side?
So reports, you report to the claims adjuster. Those reports also get sent to your client, so they kind of know what's going on in the case. But it's just there's a liability section, talking about liability, if it's accepted, if you're fighting liability. And then there's the damages section. As defense counsel, I would go through every single record of, 5,000 Kaiser bills and find the records that, this person's complaining of back pain and he was complaining of back pain for 5 years, So it's like you just have to analyze your whole case.
If you're analyzing the whole case, is it strictly dry legal analysis or is there something about the client and the lawyer in there too?
Yeah, a lot of it is to what kind of witness is plaintiff make. Is plaintiff sympathetic? If it goes to trial, will a jury like this plaintiff? What about your client? How does your client present? So that's a big part of it. There's also, you know, what kind of plaintiff's firm is this? Is this someone who...
Attorney Conger is a smarmy MF-er. He thinks he knows everything.
You know, it's like, is this a firm that tries cases, or are we going to be able to settle this for, you know, a lower value?
That's huge. Yeah. I know when I was on the defense side, there was one particular lawyer who's now a judge, and literally he would never try a case. And it was in Med Mal, and you knew that if you offered him the $30,000 reportable limit, he would take it every single time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you do not want that going in a report about you. You've got, that's, you know, why you want to at least try some cases and get a reputation for that, because that's the first thing. Every report I ever wrote, the initial report was always plaintiff's counsel. And the other thing is, and I make a big deal of this with my clients after their deposition, is, you know, my first report of every deposition was impression of the witness.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, huge. It's right in there. And that is, you want your client to make the best impression because they focus on that so heavily.
Every single deposition report I ever wrote of the hundreds, the liability discussion was section 4 and the damages discussion was section 5. 1, 2, and 3 were what did he look like, how did he present, and who was in the room representing him? Who was the right. defense? Who was the plaintiff lawyer?
It helps so much if they like your client. Yeah, really does. Yeah.
And their story. I mean, part of liking the client's liking the story, and that's the time to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe this segues to what we were talking about earlier, but I think also this goes to like reporting is when they're doing, when you're reporting. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're giving these people this information, when it's happening, how important it is to understand the triggering events that a defense attorney is writing a report to the adjuster.
What do you think are some of the more important benchmarks then, and that idea of when you give them the information? Are you a guy who believes in giving them all the information up front? Are you a drip, drip, drip kind of guy? Or are you like an old curmudgeon like me? You're never going to see the report.
I'm not an old curmudgeon like you.
Yeah.
I am somewhere in the middle. I think it depends on a case. I mean, you have different issues, different cases that require different reports to be sent. I mean, you have a big TBI and you have that CT with that brain bleed. You want them to have that right away. You maybe have a neuropsych report on an MTBI. Well, you might wait until your client's been deposed to sort of give them that neuropsych.
When should I give them this positive tox screen? Right away.
Right. Yeah.
I might hold this.
Yeah, I might hold this. Like, yeah. You know, I think it all depends.
You know what? Every case has, you know, there's duty, breach, causation, damages. How much do we like our client? There's, you know, a few things that matter in the case. Every time I have one of those issues I feel like is sewed up and it's good for me, I'll give them everything on that issue, right? And as I go, sometimes it's not that I know I have a problem, it's just that I don't know yet if I have a problem. So I'm not going to give them all my information on that till I kind of know where I'm going with it, right? But once I know where I'm going with a certain issue, then you can have everything on that issue.
Okay.
That's how I do it.
Nick talked about a little bit before, going through the gears, that there's a time to be loved and a time to be feared. Do we think that's strictly situational, or do we have in our minds a structure or some kind of parameters for when we hit third gear, fourth gear, and then Irish temper?
It's very Bronx Tale. That's very Bronx Tale of you, Tom.
Now you just can't leave. Yeah. You guys know that scene? One of the best scenes in all film? Now you just can't leave.
Some of that's personality driven. I mean, there are some people who are just super aggressive. I'm super mellow, and I'm just, that's how I'm going to be, so... To go to that fourth gear, sometimes it's like I got to really dig down and find, like, okay, now I'm really going to push these people. But I think you just want them to immediately respect you and do everything that you can to show them you're a competent lawyer.
Yeah.
A few years ago, there was this thought in the plaintiff's bar, everybody was demurring to answers.
Yeah, and I saw that like, once. It was so stirring.
And some guy did that to me once when I was a defense lawyer. I'm like, this guy doesn't have the first clue about how to be a lawyer because he's just wasting his time. And so if you're doing stupid stuff like that, it's like you're setting your case back so far. It's like, you know, you've got to know what's important. You do what's important. You don't do anything else.
I was on the phone with some Yahoo once, and we were arguing over some motion to compel about 3 months into the litigation or 4 months in. And we couldn't agree, and he got really mad, and he hung up, and he goes, I'll see you in court, click. And I said, you see me in court? Yeah. You already filed the suit. We're lawyers. Like, what? Yeah.
What court are you talking about?
What exactly is going on here? What do you think this is?
I don't know. I think how I do it is I'm a passionate guy. Mm-hmm. I get passionate about my cases. I also think I tend to just kind of walk around mildly annoyed.
That's a good look.
Yeah. I mean, it happens, right? Some of us are born this way. So because of that, like, I tend to try to keep the fire in my belly, try to keep it in the bag, mm-hmm. because once I go there, it's done. So, but with that being said, the most important thing that I do is to maintain professionalism from the beginning and kind of let the defense attorney set the rules. And how they want to play, I'll play.
So you're a guy that's comfortable with a knife fight, and you're a guy that's comfortable with a handshake deal.
I mean, obviously, look, a handshake's better. It's easier for all of us. You're not, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and thinking about how you're going to beat that guy or that gal because you guys are being everything's above board and it's cool. But I'm comfortable in both scenarios, and both scenarios have their pros and cons.
Okay.
I let the defense attorney kind of dictate how it's going to go.
All right. Z, you're fresh from the defense side. You were taking incoming fire very recently. from your perspective, having just got off the boat, what, as a defense lawyer, as an in-house, for example, what do you respond best to? It may be intuitive. It may be obvious. But do you respond to people who are kind of firm and jerks in that way? Or is it only honey that attracts more than vinegar?
I mean, to me, it was always, what type of attorney are you? You know, and I wouldn't really respond if somebody was a jerk. Like, you know, I didn't like that. But, like, there's ways to advocate for your client and advocate for your case where you were professional about it and you appeared to know what you're doing and you make the right objections, but you're not objecting at every single question I'm asking, just to be, you know, a jerk about it and, like, show your client, like, you know,
Ryan likes to look at the opponent and go, your attorney's trying to look tough. Is it working? Sorry, go ahead.
But, you know, so it's all about just being a competent, good attorney. And at the end of the day, we don't have to see eye to eye on a case. And, you know, sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But, you know, it's just about being professional, and you have your position and you can make that point in a strong but professional way. If you start, you know, just name calling and stuff, like, that's, I mean, that doesn't get you anywhere.
I think there's a common misconception on the plaintiff side for those plaintiff attorneys who have never worked on the defense side as to how much control the attorney really has over how the case settles. Like we've been talking about all day, there's so many checks and balances. You know, I think a lot of times they're like, oh, I'm getting along really well with this defense attorney. He's going to pay me on this case. Like, it's not really up to him,
yeah.
You know? So, and I think if a deal falls apart, sometimes the plaintiff attorney then becomes very frustrated with the defense attorney. And that's easy to do, but you have to think that through and hold it back, because it may not be, the attorney may still be in your camp. He or she just can't tell you that.
And that depends on the carrier, because some carriers don't listen to the lawyers at all, and some really have a good relationship and value their advice. And so
what do we do, Dave, when we're confronted with that, where you have a case and you're looking at it and you're going, man, I get along with this lawyer, we message well to each other, we communicate, but I can tell, and he's telling me, or I can tell that his carrier is just not listening to him. What do you do? Are you just SOL?
That's kind of how I feel. You just got to keep pushing. I mean, you got to make him...
Sometimes you win, sometimes it rains, and sometimes you lose.
That's right. You know, if Mercury's on the other side, I had this big case, and Mercury insured a 40-unit apartment complex. Just the absolute worst carrier you could have. They had, like, $2 million in coverage. The lawyers knew it was a problem, but it was, like, getting through to Mercury on that case was ridiculous. Paid me a lot of money, but it was still, like, you just look at that, and you're like, okay, there's no easy answer here.
Ryan, if we're stuck there, if Dave and I come to you and say, listen, we got this case and they are just not listening, and Nick, the defense lawyer, is on the other side and they're just not listening, is there anything we can do? Or are we just kind of stuck pulling an oar there?
That's when you pull your tools out. That's when you pull out the 9-9.
Pull your tools out, Ryan. Yeah. It's a family show.
I think he means his pitching wedge.
Oh, all right. Okay. That's when you do things to try to get the person's attention who you're not necessarily dealing with, right? That's when you do the 998. That's when you start noticing depositions of people whose depositions might be uncomfortable for the other side. I think you got to go to work in that situation. But if you do go to work, you got to make them pay for it, so they maybe don't do that to you the next time.
Okay. See, right? I like where this is going. There's things that can be done, and I tend to be a proponent, believer in this. if you find yourself in an impasse or some kind of junction there where you feel like no one's listening, just start putting things on paper, depot notices. Start digging in, get the leverage going.
What I always do is
RFAs are a good one.
You know, you got to get more eyes on it.
Whenever I'm at an impasse, and there's always multiple impasses at a case, right? No case. I mean, some work perfectly, but they really don't. Whenever you're at an impasse, I always think, what pressure point do I want to touch now? Mm. Send some RFAs. RFAs are great, you know, especially if you send a bunch of random ones, and then the defense is all going crazy. What do they know? Send some depots. Send another 998. You know, do some things to get it going.
Yeah, I want the insured's attention at that point. And unfortunately for the insured, sometimes he becomes the pawn, right, in the game.
Yeah.
But you're saying, listen, insured, I know you've just been sitting back in this nice, comfortable position while your insurance company tells you everything's okay, you know, because they're trying to squeeze me for a few extra bucks. But guess what? You've got some skin in the game, too. So do something to let the insured know that.
Let's define this about the insured, as long as we're talking about what's happening on the other side of the fence. We've talked about adjusters. We've talked about different lawyers and coverage people. What's the insured's role here? Whether you're a personal lines guy who's got an auto insurance, whether you're a building owner, commercial policy, what input does the insured have, if any? Or is the insured just sitting there saying, they've got it all, what do we do?
This may not be the exact answer to your question, but if I'm an insured, right, I bought a policy, I paid my premiums on time, and not only did I pay to not get hit with a big verdict and not, you know, have to pay indemnity dollars, I also paid to not have to be deposed. I paid not to be embroiled in litigation for 2 years.
I don't know if people know that.
They don't. No. And I think
it's huge. It's a big deal.
One thing that that frustrated me is knowing that, because I agree with you, Ryan. If when I pay my insurance, I don't want to be bothered. I paid my premiums. Take care of it.
But the insurance,
they get mad. Like, don't, you know, I remember getting calls like, you better not pay that person that I hit, you know, all this money. Well, you hit them at 50 miles an hour and you were drunk. So, you know, what are you talking about? But the real answer to your question is, technically, under the law, they don't have a say at all.
Yeah. Right. Their insurance policy will probably say something to the effect of the insurance company X is agreeing to pay for any judgment, award, settlement. But we also then control the rights to do what we want within the context of any claim.
Right.
Well, we talked about, you know, diverging interests, and that's probably the biggest and the most important one here, right? And sometimes you got to find a way to explain that to the insured, even though you're not allowed to talk to them. So you have to do it through the tools that are available to you, through discovery, through a deposition, through a demand, because once the insured understand, because the insured can say, oh, you know, let's go get them, this one isn't really my fault. But then all of a sudden, if the insured sees that the insured might lose its building or might lose its house or might lose its assets, then they're going, shit, insurance company, you know, get me out from under this.
So is that pressure real? If you have an insured and you're a defense lawyer and all of a sudden they pick up the phone and the weather's changed and they want something to happen to make it go away, is that real pressure on the defense setup?
It depends. I've had clients who were very adamant, like you guys have talked about, no, they shouldn't get a penny, they're liars.
Does that affect things?
No, that doesn't affect things as much, especially if it's a case already settled and they come back at you and they're all mad about it. And it's like, well, read your insurance policy. You know, this is a risk management type of deal. I think it has a little bit more pressure when there's some type of demand and the insured is, you know, says they call and they're saying, you know, I've been a client of yours for 20 years. You know, this seems pretty reasonable to me. If you don't accept, I have to do X, Y, and Z. You better pay. So, I mean, it doesn't have as much of a pull as maybe people think, but it definitely does make the insurance company kind of say, well, you know, they're a valuable client. Depends how valuable. If they have, you know, a ton of buildings or a ton of whatever, you know, insurance with us, that. You know, matters too, but
policies open.
isn't it based on, to me, it was always based on the sophistication of the insured. If I think, you know, and I'm reporting that and I'm talking about that, I'm reporting it, not directly. I'm reporting it in ways I'm not writing.
Oh, sure. That's
an art form.
You can't
say that.
That's a defense lawyer art form, to say what you mean without
saying it.
Yeah.
Right. So, it totally depends on they have personal counsel. Who is that personal counsel? Is that Simon Law Group? Is that personal counsel? Well, I better be careful. If it's, you know, you know, trafficticket.com, then okay.
According to Ryan, trafficticket.com was the best personal counsel he'd ever seen.
But so I have a question for you. Yeah. What do you think about the question in deposition to the insurer, to the defendant? Do you know that we've tried that you could have gotten your insurance company could have gotten you out of this case within your policy limits?
Yeah, I've asked that myself, and I've been asked that, or my client's been asked that. If I'm defending that deposition, I don't let you finish the question.
Right.
Okay.
But what do you think about you asking the question? Do you find it effective?
I find it effective only if the insured is sophisticated to some degree, because otherwise it's just their head. Right.
Well, the other thing about that is, I would be more likely to do it in a case where I really didn't care for defense counsel.
Right, you have
to have a good relationship. That's a huge go flag. I'm never going to do that. Yeah.
I had this happen one time. I was covering a deposition for Sevi, and they wouldn't let him know whether or not there was a reservation of rights on this policy. It was a $250 policy with a $5 million excess. Mm-hmm. And he said, they just keep jerking me around. They won't tell me whether or not there's a reservation on the $5 million. It was big damages, so it was really mattered, right? Mm-hmm. And the guy was pretty wealthy guy that the insured. I waited till the end of the depo, obviously, because I didn't want to get off on a bad foot. But I showed him both deck pages and I said, you understand you have two policies, right? The primary, this one, and that's who's hired these lawyers to defend you. And he said, yeah. I said, you understand you have this other policy too, right? That's this $5 million umbrella policy that's on top of the 250. Do you understand what that means? And he said, yeah. I said, has anybody ever told you from your insurance company or anybody else that, the $5 million insurance company is saying that this may not apply and that anything above the 250 might be on you personally? And he started also looking at his lawyer. What is that true? What's going on with that? And they said, let's go off the record. I said, let's stay on. Is there a reservation of rights or not? And he said, let's go off the record. We finally went off the record. He found out for me that same day whether there was a reservation of rights, and there wasn't.
Sometimes I just want to be Ryan, you know? He's just so good with this stuff.
I really don't want to be Ryan. No. I'm happy just over here watching
happy being
it.
Dave. Yeah.
Dave knows what goes on in my mind. Yeah, exactly.
But to go back to Nick's question, that question in deposition, in my mind, I think it's one of these things. My posture always in deposition is you kind of do what you can do until they stop you.
Sure.
Like, just keep going until you get some pushback.
Well,
But I would ask that question to agree with Dave if there was a little bit of bad blood and you wanted a little bit of shot, an elbow in the ribs.
Agreed.
Was I over the line there, you think?
Yes.
No, because you got the information you're looking for.
You're good.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair.
You needed to know that issue. They wouldn't tell you, and you got
the information. He had been jerking him around for 3 weeks, and this guy needed treatment, and we didn't, you know.
Well, the other thing is that's a question that they would have to answer in discovery anyway.
They should have already answered it in discovery in the form rog responses.
Yeah, yeah. So that's fair to put that to somebody.
Yeah. And again, I think it depends entirely on the sophistication.
Sevi filed like 3 days after the accident. Yeah.
There's plenty of insureds out there who have little to no sophistication, and it's just water in one ear out the other.
I also think it depends on what the number is. Like, I've had a plaintiff attorney ask my client, like, oh, did you know we served this 998 for $20,000? And, you know, it's like, he doesn't care. Like, his policy's, you know, more than $20,000. So it's like, it's kind of an intimidation tactic that doesn't work if it's some, you know, just small number. If it's a bigger number and it makes them kind of think and question and be like, oh, no, that's a lot of money, but if it's something small, then forget it.
You're saying don't go to an MCLE and then try it on your next depo, whether it really whether it really works
exactly.
or not.
I got the wrap up signal from technician Timmy and terrific Teresa here, so we're gonna wind it down. I'm just gonna maybe some relevance, but the greatest all time deposition question was a colleague of ours who had a bar owner and some fight happened, and this guy was enraged. This insured was enraged that there was a lawsuit filed against him. It was just apoplectic. And they sit down for a deposition, and they get sworn in, and the guy leans across. He goes, do you know why you're here? Dude just lost his mind. Do you know why you're here? Anyway, all right. So that's our session for today. I want to thank all of my esteemed guests, Ryan, Nick, Dave, and Zanetta, for joining us for another Simon Law Group Justice Team podcast. And also Murat for these tasty drinks.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks, Murat.
For the 6 to 9 drinks consumed by the panel. We appreciate that.
And thank you to you, Tom. for being such a wonderful host.
And as always, we sign off with our signature, No Sleep Till Justice.
All right. Policy Opener. It's a tragic story of a TBI and an injured disc. Here's the MRI. We know that your limits are just 15K. Hope you blow.